President Putin calls on the Russian defense industry to increase its weapons production to meet the needs of the army for the war in Ukraine. China expresses anger at a new U.S. law that boosts military assistance for Taiwan, saying it will damage peace and stability in the volatile region. Also ahead, airlines cancel thousands of flights in the U.S. as a massive winter storm disrupts airport operations.
Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us.
Our top story, Russia's president urges the country's defense industry to increase its production to meet the needs of forces fighting in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin has told the industry's chiefs to make sure that the army receives the military equipment in the shortest possible time. He made the remarks during a visit to a weapon manufacturing center. Putin also said the industry should improve the technical quality of the equipment. This comes as Western countries, especially the United States, have been supplying Ukraine with billions of dollars worth of advanced weapons since the beginning of the war in February. The U.S. House of Representatives, meanwhile, has approved a $45 billion aid package for Ukraine. The military and economic assistance is part of a $1.6 trillion government funding bill that has passed the Senate. It will now go to U.S. President Joe Biden to be signed into law. The U.S. has been Ukraine's main military sponsor in the war with Russia. It has already sent aid worth around $50 billion to Ukraine this year. Moscow has repeatedly warned that foreign military aid for Ukraine will only drag out the war and escalate the human suffering. The war in Ukraine has plunged Moscow-Washington ties to their lowest point in decades. Russia's ambassador to the U.S. has compared the state of the relations to an ice age, warning of the high risk of a clash.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has visited Washington in a much-publicized visit to the U.S. This is the first foreign visit that Zelensky has made to the U.S. since the war began back in February. During a meeting at the White House, President Joe Biden pledged to give more military support to Ukraine, including a new missile system.
As I said, Mr. President, you don't have to worry. We are staying with Ukraine as long as Ukraine is there. Thank you all.
The U.S. pledged $1.85 billion in military aid for Ukraine, including a Patriot missile system. Ukrainian officials have continuously called on the U.S. to deliver that system. Biden said the U.S. and Ukraine would continue to project a, quote, united defense against Russia as the war drags on. And as expected, the visit has drawn an angry response from Russia. Moscow's envoy to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, has denounced the visit as a, quote, Hollywood-style trip, accusing Washington of throwing all of its colossal resources, weapons, and intelligence capabilities at Kiev. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has said that there had been no signs of readiness for peace talks during Zelensky's visit. He further noted that this was evidence that the U.S. was fighting a proxy war with Russia, quote, to the last Ukrainian. The Pentagon has disclosed that the U.S. has sent $20 billion worth of military aid to Ukraine in 2022. The recent $1.7 trillion federal spending bill includes $45 billion that's earmarked for Ukraine in 2023. Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu noted earlier that Kiev had already received more than $97 billion worth of weapons and ammunition, and that Russia was already fighting the entire West and NATO.
So the U.S. continues to supply Ukraine with arms and military equipment, despite growing calls from some Republican congressmen for more scrutiny over aid delivered to Kiev. And some polls also suggest the support for the U.S. backing of the war in Ukraine is waning.
As the West, spearheaded by the U.S., continues to pour more military and economic aid packages to Ukraine, there are now calls for more transparency. In the U.S., Republicans are calling for plans to exercise oversight powers to scrutinize tens of billions of dollars that the U.S. has spent. Republicans have been more skeptical than their Democratic counterparts in the Senate about funding Ukraine's defenses. Some Republicans have cited corruption in Ukraine, saying that there are concerns about the aid going to the country. prior to the Ukrainian president's remarks, a few Republicans had already made public their opposition to the spending bill and further aid to Ukraine. We should be focused on trying to contain the war, not expand the war. And this sends the message that we are kind of okay with expanding the war. And I think we should be sending a different message, is what Warren Davidson, a Republican congressman, has said. Another Republican congressman, Matthew Gaetz, has criticized Zelensky, saying that American politicians who indulge his requests are unwilling to put Ukraine first.
You've got Americans here at home that are demanding accountability on our southwest border. You've got crime rampant. You've got historic inflation. You have a litany of issues that we all are paying for at the behest of this administration. And no one can tell us where this money is going. My heart breaks for the Ukrainians, absolutely. But every American deserves to know where every single dollar has gone.
This comes amid a declining support of Republican voters for more military aid to Ukraine. In the latest poll, 33% of Republicans agreed with prolonged support compared to 61% of Democrats and 46% of independents.
Turning to other news now, Russia's foreign minister has called for de-escalation in the Nagorno-Karabakh region. That's after the only link between the region and Armenia was blocked by a group of Azerbaijani activists. Lavrov says he hopes that the movement along the key road will be restored as soon as possible. He made the remarks following talks with his Azerbaijani counterparts in Moscow. The corridor, which is a key supply route for food, medicine and fuel, has been obstructed since last week by a group styling itself as environmental activists. Armenia says they are backed by the Azerbaijani government to create a humanitarian crisis in the mountainous enclave. Baku, however, accuses Russian peacekeepers of closing the road link. The Azerbaijan Republic regained control of the region after a 2021 war with Armenia. From nurses to teachers to railway employees, British workers in various sectors have been staging back-to-back walkouts since the summer, and now air travellers in the country are warned of delays as passport control staff go on strike ahead of Christmas. The Public and Commercial Services Union says over 1,000 Border Force staff walked out of their jobs on Friday. This is the first day of their industrial action, which is due to last until the new year, as they are dissatisfied with their pay, demanding raises. According to the union, the government's 2% raise offer doesn't keep pace with a double-digit inflation in the country. The industrial unrest is expected to upend travel plans in the coming days. Britain's busiest airport, Heathrow, says passengers should be prepared for travel disruptions. The UK is reeling from strikes over pay and working conditions, and that's amid a cost of living crisis combined by fears of a recession.
2022 has been dominated by a cost of living crisis, and the figures are staggering. Inflation is running at a double-digit pace, the highest in 40 years, and far outpacing wage growth. While food prices have shot up almost 20%, and the cost of heating a typical home has jumped more than 150%. As temperatures plummet below zero and desperation rises, key sector worker unions have launched mass strike actions to pressure the government to force wage rises.
The people who are out here on strike today are the same people who not only worked through the pandemic, we worked for the people, we'd get their prescriptions, we'll get their milk and bread.
We just want a pay rise in line with the cost of living. At the moment, what we're getting is actually terms of a pay cut. So it's not even in line with inflation. Everything's gone up. We're just like everybody else. We're all struggling.
This is not about pay. This is about our jobs.
The situation has become so dire in Britain that many families will have to choose whether to heat their homes or feed their families this Christmas.
It is very distressing. It's a situation which, in a way, unimaginable for a country which is supposed to be one of the richest countries in Europe and in the West. Why is it we have these extremes of poverty? Why are people some people forced to choose between heating and eating. I mean, there's something completely wrong about our system. We should be plugging and supporting and promoting equality and, you know, not oppressing the poor. You know, there's something which says a lot about our political system, which is flawed.
The government has pinned much of the blame on economic recovery from the COVID era. However, critics say its ruling Conservative Party incompetence and leadership instability that has also left the economy in a dire state. A lesser discussed reason for a European-wide crisis is the ongoing Ukraine war. Britain has remained a staunch supporter of continued fighting, even upping its shipments of arms and financial support.
I think the first is ensuring that we deliver more military aid and that that military aid evolves to meet the situation that we're now facing. And that means more air defence systems, it means artillery, it means armoured vehicles. For our part in the United Kingdom, we've pledged to match or exceed the £2.3 billion in aid that we provided this year, next year.
Low wages, higher fuel costs, inflation and major strike action have all marred 2022. Does the government have what it takes to resolve these many issues in 2023? Probably not. It's going to be a long road with most likely higher taxation, major cuts in public spending and renewed pressure on an already struggling British working class. Robert Carter, London.
Police have clashed with protesters in the French capital Paris after a deadly shooting with a suspected racist motive on a Kurdish center. Protesters gathered near the site of the shooting, hurling stones at the police, and security forces fired tear gas and attempted to disperse the crowd. French President Emmanuel Macron called the shooting an odious attack. The Interior Minister has reinforced police protection of Kurdish community sites in Paris and elsewhere across the country. A 69-year-old has been arrested in connection with the shooting, which killed three people and injured three others. The suspect was known to authorities and had a history of racism and attacks on foreign nationals, especially the Kurds. China says it's resolutely opposed to a new US law that boosts military assistance for Taiwan. Beijing says the law contains provisions that cause serious damage to peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. Taipei, however, has welcomed the legislation, which provided it with $10 billion in security aid. Taiwan says the U.S. move shows the importance Washington attaches to ties with the island and its security. Taiwan has been a source of tension between China and the U.S. for years now, and that's because the U.S. continues to supply arms to the island, which China considers its own territory. Beijing says Washington's assistance emboldens Taipei in its independence push. Japan's decision to boost its military spending has drawn strong rebukes from civic leaders in South Korea. Tokyo argues its move to build up its forces comes amid threats from North Korea and China. Tokyo's arms purchases also provide a boon for U.S. weapons producers. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counterstrike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that, more than $300 billion, is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Thousands of flights have been canceled in the U.S. as a massive winter storm brings airport operations down to a crawl. Nearly 7,000 flights were canceled on Friday and Thursday, leaving holiday travelers frustrated. The Federal Aviation Administration imposed ground stops and delays to de-ice a number of airport runways as a result of the storms. Some 4,000 U.S. flights were also delayed on Friday. Poor weather conditions have also disrupted railroad travel in the holiday season, forcing the cancellation of dozens of trains.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan power's policies and recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. Some famous athletes and actors have also taken their own stance. In my opinion, this has no importance. You should not focus on these issues. Our athletes are part of a good community, and so are our actors. There are many faithful, loving, honorable people in these communities. Now, when a few people say some things, this is not of any significance. It is up to the judiciary to determine whether or not their statements are considered crimes. But generally speaking, their words have no significance or value. These behaviors that make our enemies happy do not have the ability to contaminate our community of actors and athletes. The last thing I would like to say is to send many greetings to the police who have been martyred, the martyrs in the armed forces, the martyrs for national security, the recent martyrs, and all the martyrs who were on the path of righteousness. May Allah's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A few strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his immaculate progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. I welcome you, dear brothers and dear sisters. You are influential figures for the important issue of the country. One of the important things that the judiciary does is influencing the most important issues of the country. This is the role you play. God willing, you will be successful. This is a grace from God. I'm pleased. And thanks to God, this epidemic has become somewhat less now, and we have been blessed with this success of being able to visit you in person. First of all, I wish to honor the memory of the dear martyr, the late Ayatollah Beheshti. May Allah be pleased with him. All the martyrs who were martyred along with him, as well as the martyrs of the judiciary. May God exalt the degrees of all of them by His grace.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me
Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has been quoted as saying that migration from nations in Africa will end if countries like France stopped exploiting the continent's people and natural resources. The remarks made before she became Prime Minister have ignited anger in Paris. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the fallout between France and Italy of African migrants entering Europe through the Mediterranean Sea. Italian officials believe that continued plundering of African countries by France is the reason for the flow of illegal migrants from Africa. The second part of our program will be on renewed fighting in the Democratic Republic of Congo amid accusations between Kigali and Kinshasa over who is responsible for the upsurge in rebel attacks. Our experts will give us their incisive analysis of these topics, and you can be part of the conversation by sending us your comments through our social media handle.
Italy slams French colonialism in Africa. A video of Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni condemning French economic imperialism in Africa during an interview she gave to an Italian TV in January 2019 has recently re-emerged and received much praise both in Europe and Africa. The viral video came amid tensions between Italy and France over a migrant rescue ship. Italy's policy of keeping its ports closed to ships carrying rescued migrants has raised tensions between Rome and Paris.
Italy's new government barred the Ocean Viking ship from docking with 230 migrants. France termed the move as unacceptable behavior, but Italy insists it's been taking in its share of migrants. The Italian Prime Minister blasted the response by France, describing it as incomprehensible and unjustified.
I've been very much struck by the French government's aggressive reaction, which from my point of view is incomprehensible and unjustified. Almost 90,000 people have entered Italy since the start of the year. On the same day of our discussions about the Ocean Viking, 600 people arrived in small boats. But for 234 people, they've made diplomatic relations blow up.
For more on the latest part between Italy and France over African migrants, we contacted Don DeBer, an activist and commentator. Thanks for your time today. Now, was the Italian Prime Minister justified in saying migration from Africa would stop if countries like France halted exploitation of the continent's valuable resources?
Well, this is true of the immigration waves around the world. It's the same situation here with the massive immigration from Central and South America and the Caribbean. People are following their stuff basically to the, you know, to the empire. In the case of Africa, Africa's been looted by Europe, you know, 500 years now. And the things that were built with the wealth of Africa and on the back of African labor, both Africans working in Africa and Africans that were stolen and dragged off, either at, by force or by, you know, market force, to build, you know, these wonderful cities on the hill. That's where all their wealth is. So that's, they're going there too to try to have some of it. That's an absolutely correct statement. France, as a matter of fact, is one of the, you know, next to the U.S. and the U.K., one of the worst offenders, and as a matter of fact, has been recapturing its colonies in the last 10, 15 years.
The French-Italian feud is the latest episode in the standoff over where to disembark refugees, picked up after trying to reach Europe from North Africa. In 2019, the then Italian Deputy Prime Minister, Luigi Di Maio, accused France of continuing to colonize Africa and causing people to migrate from the continent.
There are dozens of African countries where France is printing a currency of its own, the franc of the colonies. And with that currency, French debt is financed. If France didn't have African colonies, which it's impoverishing, it would be the 15th world economic power.
It appears there are deep-rooted differences between Italy and France in Africa. The spat between Rome and Paris is seen by many as rivalry between two European powers that colonized African countries.
Imputing intent is a fool's errand. But the history of Italy in Africa is distinct from the history of France, certainly, and of some other colonial powers. Italy was, in the modern age, mostly confined to the northeastern part of Africa and the eastern, you know, the Horn, particularly Ethiopia and Libya. And Libya, as a matter of fact, is like 400 kilometers from Sicily, from, you know, from Italy, across the Mediterranean. But the critique is correct. Even as France was kicked out as the colonial power nominally, they preserve the right to print the currency for these countries. In other words, the economy of each of these countries was still entirely in the hands of Paris.
Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni said in Rome recently that Italy can lead in EU-Africa cooperation. Now, she claimed that Italy will pursue a non-predatory but collaborative posture. Now, can African countries really trust Italy, which appears to indicate that it has the continent's interests at heart?
Italy has Italy's interests at heart. You can only hope that the leaders of Italy have at least that much. You know, the Africans have their own interests at heart. And the proof, you know, whatever deal someone brings to Africa, whether it's good or bad for Africa, will be determined by people in Africa and by Africans. And they will test who's a good partner and an honest partner and who's not as they engage and as they have engaged. There is competition now. Before, you had the United States, you had European countries, which are under the military occupation of the United States. That was basically it. And the relationship was essentially, they come there with guns, they point the guns at the people, they tell them, go into the mines and bring us all the stuff, put it on our boats, and then they leave. And they come back for more when the boat's empty. So what Italy intends to do or doesn't intend to do, you know, you can go all the way back to Carthage and look at the relationship. I mean, there's a lot of contradictions there. But what matters is that Africans have agency that is protected by the world community to make up their own mind about what's good or not good for them and to act accordingly.
The vast majority of Africans attempting the Mediterranean crossing to Europe pass through Libya. Now, Italy and France were both involved in NATO's military intervention in Libya that destabilized the country and created the current migrant crisis. What's your take on this?
Well, yeah. Right now, Libya is basically a failed state with various factions competing for power. And the United States, you have the CIA backs one faction, the Pentagon backs another. This kind of disruption in people's lives, the disruption in labor markets in Europe, the disruption in, you know, the lives of people in Africa. There are some people who make money on all of it. And they're making policy in the United States, and they're making policy in Brussels as well for the EU. And so the solution is going to be to stabilize all of the places where, you know, the empires created chaos, basically. Let people sit still where they are and repair and rebuild their homes and, you know, their towns and all the things that keep being destroyed by, you know, U.S. bombings and terrorist attacks and such that are financed by the West. And just let people live their own lives. That'll solve the problem.
More than 50,000 people worldwide have lost their lives during their migratory journeys since the International Organization of Migration started documenting deaths in its Missing Migrants Project in 2014. Africa is the second deadliest region for people on the move, with more than 9,000 deaths during migration documented on the continent since 2014. Leading Pan-Africanist PLO Lumumba says African migrants are compelled to take the dangerous journey across the Mediterranean because African countries are weak.
I watched a woman from Nigeria who had been rescued from the Mediterranean around Lampedusa say, I will not go back to Africa. Even if I die in the Mediterranean, I'll try again and again. What is it that can make a human being say that I do not want to go back to my home? Because the natural instinct of a human being should be that you want to go home. It's because we are weak.
Now, what, in your opinion, is a solution that will reduce the flow of African economic migrants to Europe?
They've weaponized the poor people by sending them out of their own homes, blowing up their homes, basically, in Africa and Asia and Latin America. And people move to places where there's jobs and homes and other things that you need to live. And this depresses labor markets and changes the entire political configuration and creates chaos in everybody's lives except for the people that sit on top. And so, you know, whatever solution is done, the real solution is to stop destroying people's homes, stop starving them with sanctions, stop making war on them, stop backing terrorists, etc. Just leave people alone and let them do business with the things that they have, and people will be fine. They'll figure the rest of it out.
Well, there you have it. If Western countries stop spreading wars and plundering other countries, the problem of illegal migration will be solved. I'd like to thank our guest Don Diba for his insight. Let's now take a short break before we turn our attention to the upsurge of deadly violence in the mineral-rich eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us.
Rising tensions in the DRC. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Hundreds of people have been killed over the last few weeks in the Democratic Republic of Congo in attacks blamed on the M23 rebel group. Now, the killing of innocent civilians started just days after the announcement of a fragile ceasefire agreement.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo repeatedly accuses neighboring Rwanda of backing the M23 rebels, an accusation that Rwanda regularly denies. In a bid to stop the violence in the mineral-rich eastern DRC, the East African Community decided to deploy troops in one of its member states for the first time in June 2022. The deployment in the Democratic Republic of the Congo will test the regional body's ability to respond to complex conflicts.
Meanwhile, the people of Eastern DRC have been holding protests following increased attacks by the M23 rebels.
Our fellow citizens were killed by the M23 terrorists, and the president declared 3 days of national mourning.
It's too much. We've had enough. We don't want war. We are here for peace. Congolese people want peace, but our neighbors don't want to give it to us.
Now to discuss the ongoing violent conflict in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, we have contacted Claude Gatebuke. He's the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Gatebuke is also the co-author of the book Survivors Uncensored. Thanks for your time today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what's the reason for the upsurge of insecurity in the eastern part of DRC, where many civilians have been killed?
You know, the basic reason for the violence in the Congo, and it's constant there, and that is the riches of the Congo. The Congo is the richest country in natural resources. It has over $24 trillion, or an estimated $24 trillion worth of resources in its soil. So there is a scramble for resources in the Congo by multinationals around the globe, mostly Western multinationals. And then to be able to access it, the West has decided that it's best to use its local mercenaries to invade the Congo, create insecurity, and plunder and loot the resources of the Congo.
Former Kenyan president Uhuru Kenyatta is the East African Community mediator in the DRC. Speaking early December in Nairobi on progress made in the latest round of talks aimed at securing peace in eastern DRC, he called on all foreign troops to leave the country.
I want to say the problem of foreign groups engaging in Congo and leaving destruction.
I have taken it up with the leadership of the East African community. And the same groups need to engage with their governments and leave Congo in peace.
53 armed groups from the Democratic Republic of Congo that met in Kenya for the third East African community-led Nairobi peace process have agreed to lay down their arms as Kinshasa. There is a lot of skepticism if this fragile agreement will finally bring sustainable peace to the DRC.
I wish I could say that peace is finally coming to the DRC, but at the end of the day, in order for the DRC to have lasting peace, there has to be truth and there has to be justice. And justice in the DRC will have to start with the crimes documented in the UN mapping exercise report that was published by the UN and is now collecting dust at the UN for the last 12 years. And that document, that report, 600 pages almost, over 600 incidents, major atrocities committed in the Congo for a period of 10 years. And then since then, there has been even more. Until there is justice on those crimes, there is not going to be lasting peace in the Congo. And that type of justice is going to have to take on US, UK, European Union allies.
President Paul Kagame of Rwanda and Felix Tshisekedi of the DRC have exchanged harsh words and blamed each other for backing rebel groups. Now, do you think tensions between the two leaders will jeopardize the fragile truce reached in Nairobi?
There is no fragile truce. Just in the last week, the last couple of weeks, there were massacres of hundreds of people in areas occupied by the Rwandan military in the Congo. They call themselves the M23. But it's M23 rebels, but it's the Rwandan troops and Ugandan troops that are backing them. They committed massacres of hundreds of civilians. So exchanging words, when they weren't exchanging words, there was no truce. They were still killing people. The invasions were still happening. So it's not about the war of words. I think the clarity is actually important. At some point, the world has to accept the fact that what is happening in the Congo is not internal rebellions, and we can stop pretending and we can talk about the reality of Rwanda and Uganda invading Congo.
Well, amid the upsurge in rebel attacks in eastern DRC, anti-United Nations protests have been held several times. Most of these protests have taken place in the streets of the city of Goma against the country's UN mission known as the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Residents accuse the UN mission, known by its French acronym MONUSCO, of failing to stop armed groups' decades-old fighting.
We've been watching the UN mission since the start. They have the logistical capacity they need. What are they doing with that? This is why we need to kick them out.
UN peacekeeping forces have failed to restore peace in the DRC, and now East African countries have deployed troops in eastern DRC. Foreign forces in eastern DRC have come under sharp criticism for failing to stop the massacre of civilians.
Let me start with the UN peacekeeping mission. They've been there for more than 20 years, I believe. Their budget, the last time I checked, was about $1 billion a year. I have to double check that number. It's $1 billion a year, I believe. But they are not engaged in actually stopping the violence. So the way I see it, the UN troops are just a force that's in the Congo as part of one of many who are exploiting the Congolese people, the resources of the Congo, and enriching themselves. The Congo doesn't need more military. In fact, what needs to happen is an arms embargo on the countries that are invading the Congo so that they do not have the weapons to invade the Congo.
In November, irate Congolese citizens burnt European Union flags during a protest in the city of Bukavu in eastern DRC against the M23 rebels. They also blamed Western powers such as the United States, Britain, and France for backing violence in this mineral-rich region.
The population living in the east of the DRC is the victim of multiple attacks by Rwanda and Uganda, with the blessing of the great powers, mainly the United States of America, Great Britain, France, and other countries. Let us express to the whole world our discontent with what we call injustice and international discrimination against the Congolese people that we are.
Western powers, through their regional proxies, have been accused of backing rebels in the DRC with the express objective of continuing the looting of Congo's minerals. Now, is the notorious M23 rebel group indirectly backed by Western imperialist powers?
Yes, I've said this before. The M23 rebel group, which is the deadliest in the Congo today and in yesteryears, which is also a reincarnation of multiple other previous rebel groups, is an extension of Western imperialism and Western neocolonialist policy in the region.
Our guest there says Western powers are backing the M23 rebel group that has killed thousands of Congolese civilians over the last few years in the mineral-rich Eastern DRC. Our time is up. We shall keep our eyes on the situation in the Eastern DRC and give you in-depth analysis on this conflict. I'd like to thank Claude Gachabuke for his time today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Drop us a line through our social media handle. Goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have Hujjatul Islam Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Hujjatul Islam Karimi. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh, for today's discussion, we want to talk about an important event in the early Islamic history, and that is the usurpation of Fadak, Hadithatul Fadak. About Lady Fatima Zahra's reaction to that and her replies to the usurpers of Fadak on that time. Let's talk a little bit about this fertile village near Khaybar called Fadak in Hejaz. Whose property was it and why Hazrat Lady Fatima Zahra, we can say, was after owning this fertile village again for herself?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Because it belonged to her, to have a short answer to this question. We know that Fadak belonged to the Jews of Khaybar, and when this land was conquered by the Muslims without any war in the year 7 after Hijrah. We know that they accepted, the Jews of Khaybar accepted the, I mean, to come to a kind of agreement with the prophet, and they gave half of the lands to the prophet.
Yes.
So according to the Islamic rulings, these types of lands are called fay. I mean, whatever land is conquered without any kind of fighting is called fay.
Yes.
And based on the verses 6 and 7 of chapter Hajj, all these lands only belong to the prophet, and the prophet may give it to whoever he wishes. Of course, we know that he does based on divine orders.
Yes.
And all the Shia scholars and some of the Sunni scholars agree that when the verse wa'ati dal qurba haqqa, and give the relatives their rights, was revealed, the Holy Prophet gave Fadak to Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha. It's been mentioned by many Sunni scholars as well, like Suyuti in Ad-Durr al-Manthur, Thalabi in his book of tafsir known as Al-Kashfu wal-Bayan, Hakim Haskan in Shawahid al-Tanzil, Muttaqi al-Hindi in Kanzul al-Umar, and many other Sunni scholars as well.
And what do you mean by giving by Prophet Muhammad as an inheritance?
No. We know that when a man is alive, we cannot talk about inheritance.
Okay.
The Holy Prophet gave Fadak to Fatima salamullahi alayha as a kind of gift. So when you're alive, you are able to distribute
your wealth
to whomever you wish. Fadak belonged to the Prophet, and the Prophet gave it to Fatima not as a kind of inheritance or earth.
Yes.
And this is one of the important points, that because the first caliph claimed that he's taking back Fadak to Baytul Mal because the prophets do not leave any inheritance. But the point is that it was not given to Fatima salamullah alayha as a kind of inheritance. As long as the Holy Prophet is alive, to talk about inheritance is meaningless.
Yes.
So during his life, the Holy Prophet gave Fadak to Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha as a kind of gift. But unfortunately, after the demise of the Prophet, it was usurped by the caliph of the time.
Okay.
And then...
And is it true that, for example, there was an ayah on this, for example, giving?
Yeah, and I mentioned the verse, Atid al-Qurba haqqa, who was revealed.
The haqq, the right.
The right, yes, yeah. Okay. And because of this verse, the Holy Prophet gave Fadak to Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha.
Okay.
And as you rightly mentioned, Lady Zahra Salamullah Alayha did her best to, retake and take back Fadak, because for sure it was her own property and it was usurped. I will talk about the reasons, but let's talk about, what happened after the demise of the Prophet. It was usurped. The Holy Lady Zahra Salamullah Alayha went to Abu Bakr and discussed with him regarding, this land. And the discussion is mentioned in Shia and Sunni sources. Like Abu Bakr says that the Holy Prophet did not leave any inheritance, and Lady Zahra Salamullah Alayha said that it was given to me by my father as a kind of gift, not as a kind of inheritance.
Yes.
And then,
The Abu Bakr's claim was based on what?
There is a narration that Abu Bakr is referring to, that نحن معاشر الأنبياء لا نورث. We, the prophets, do not leave any inheritance. But the point is that, according to the Shia, this narration has no basis and is a fake narration.
Yes.
Because of the fact that the Noble Book of Quran talk about the prophets inheriting from each other, and the prophets leaving inheritance, like Waritha Sulaiman, Dawood.
Yes.
The Quran is very explicit in saying that the prophets also leave inheritance.
And you said that this was not an inheritance.
Yeah.
It was a heba. It was a kind of gift given to Lady Fatima. That's right. Okay.
So, according to some reports, then Abu Bakr asked for some witnesses, and Lady Zahra Salamullah Alayha, and after that, Imam Ali alayhi salam and Umm Ayman witnessed, and he was about to give Fadak to Fatima al-Zahra salamun alayha. But according to some narrations, the second caliph prevented that, and according to some reports, even paper was given to Lady Zahra Salamullah Alayha, in which it was written that that Fadak belongs to him, but the second caliph tore it, and the rest of the story, which is mentioned in the historical sources.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Ibn Abil Hadid, the famous Sunni scholar, says that I asked Ibn al-Fariqi, one of the famous Sunni scholars of that time, that was Fatima Salamun alayha telling the truth? He said, yes.
Okay.
Then I asked why Abu Bakr did not give her Fadak, and Ibn al-Fariqi has a very profound answer. He says that because had he given Fadak to her back, yes, then the following day, Fatima Salamullah alayha would claim caliphate for her husband, that yes, is Imam Ali alayhi salam. And Abu Bakr was not able to accept, to reject her words, because he has already accepted her words about Fadak. Now, next, when Fatima Zahra Salamullah alayha, when she was not able to take back Fadak, we have Imam Ali alayhi salam trying his best. He goes to the mosque and talks to the immigrants and the helpers, and he also addressing Abu Bakr,
yes,
talks about the fact that this is a land belonging to Fatima Zahra salamun alayha. He recites Ayatul Tathir. And then we have the famous khutbah of Lady Fatima Zahra, yes, the famous sermon known as the Sermon of Fadakiyah,
yes,
in which she not only talks about her right to Fadak, but yes, she talks about different issues, the yes, most important of which is the right of Imam Ali alayhi salam, okay, regarding caliphate.
Now this is the main question that we do not find any struggle for, we can say, mundane world, for, we can say, the materialistic world in the life of Imam Ali and Lady Fatima al-Zahra. But her struggle for getting back the ownership of Fadak for sure has a profound reason in her mind. Do you know what were those reasons?
Yeah, there are a couple of points that we may take into consideration. First of all, at the end of the day, a kind of usurpation has happened. So according to Islamic teachings, you are not allowed to oppress people, and at the same time you are not allowed to accept, to submit to oppression of other people toward you. So Islam does not agree for Muslims to be suppressed. No, if someone is usurping your properties, then just resist. So, the first point is that at the end of the day, a land which belongs to you is usurped, and it is your right to, reject, to oppose that. So it is very natural for Fatima Zahra Salamun Alayha to object, to try her best to take it back.
Okay.
This is the apparent understanding of the event, which yes, is in and of itself important. At the end of the day, as I mentioned, it belongs to you. Some people, they are trying to usurp, and now it is your right to defend your right and to take it back. Second of all, according to some scholars, Lady Fatima Zahra Salamun Alayha at the same time is trying to reveal the true nature of the caliphs to the people, to tell them that they are usurping a right of the daughter of Fatima Zahra Salamun Alayha, because at that time not all the Muslims knew all the realities about all the companions of the Prophet. So through her efforts, Fatima Zahra Salamun Alayha is trying her best to reveal such realities to all the Muslims.
And also maybe the concept of justice, exactly, is not done, for example, and they are getting back into the Jahiliya period,
definitely,
of injustice. That's right.